It's the Rooks and Beckards podcast, episode 9. This is a place for lovers of books and records. My name is Ted, and on this episode, we're going to mix it up a bit as far as the order of the segments. First off, my co-host John Young and I get into a chat with Michael Magali about Tom Petty and his stature in the genre of rock. I'm not a fan of his music, but John and Michael are, and maybe some sparks are going to fly because of that conflict. The second segment, I take a look at an unlikely number one album that shot to the top of the charts in the UK. And in books, I want to spotlight some short reads. But first, let's get started with some Tom Petty talk. Tom Petty died in 2017, but the music he made with the Heartbreakers and as a solo artist still gets plenty of radio airplay. There's no doubting the longevity of his career, how prolific he was as a songwriter, and his dedication to playing live. However, like many artists, his music didn't appeal to everyone, and that includes yours truly, which is odd because the style of his music fits within my musical wheelhouse. I'm a big fan of Bob Dylan and Dire Straits, so one would think that I would be a Tom Petty fan. Nope. Nada. But my co-host, 95.3 KUIC morning show host, John Young is here, and so is my fellow co-worker at iHeartMedia, Michael Magali. We're going to talk about Petty's music in this segment of the Rooks and Beckards podcast. John, let me formally say, how are you, my friend?
I am great, Ted, and don't think that by the end of this podcast, you won't be running out to buy every bit of Tom Petty's catalog when Michael and I get done with you.
And Michael, nice to have you in the mix.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Ted, for a second time after our Who discussion. And John, super cool to be with you, man.
Thank you, Michael. Feel the same.
Michael, I'm going to start with you. You've been a Petty fan since the 80s, I'm guessing. So what albums, or maybe what album did it for you, you know, made you a fan?
I just want to start and focus on the debut album, which is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And for me, it just carries so much magic. Tom Petty, a musical hero for me. The debut album is kind of a full circle thing for me from 1976 when it was released, kind of growing up with it as a kid. And then later on when I had the album myself in high school and college. And then fast forward to the 40th anniversary tour, which marked the debut of this album in 2017, as you mentioned. And I was lucky enough to see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers at the Greek Theater at the end of that tour in August of 17, which was just about 1 month before he died. So it definitely carries a special meaning for me, this particular album. And I find it really genuine and raw. The casual listener might say, oh, yeah, I know Breakdown, cool song. Oh, yeah, American Girl. Yeah. The rest of the album, I'm a little fuzzy here. But for me, it kind of clicked in from the beginning that this band was legit. They had some real fire and passion. And the rest of this album is really raw, you know, a little rough around the edges, but it's genuine. And there's a depth in the songs. And Petty's skill as a songwriter, as a storyteller, that's evident from the very beginning. And then he has this great vehicle in the Heartbreakers, this band that really just kind of came together. They really were in the right place, right time, after the prior experiment, Mudcrutch, had kind of dissolved about a year earlier.
What a bad name for a band.
I know. we're not off to a good start, Michael.
Yeah, so these guys are floating around in the LA music scene, and Benmont Tench, you know, original Heartbreaker, and Stan Lynch, who would become the drummer, and added a real edge to the sound of this early original lineup of the band. They had put together and booked some recording time in a studio and had the session time, and they brought in all of their guys, all still floating around the LA scene, from the Gainesville, Florida music scene. So they were familiar with each other, and it was really just kind of catching lightning in a bottle with this album, which I go back to and look at now. You take the two hits out of it, you've got three other just great straight ahead rockers, Rocking Around With You, Hometown Blues, and anything that's rock and roll. And then you've got two kind of slower tempo songs, kind of a ballad, the Wild One Forever. And it's really just the passion of Petty's voice, how he can just convey the imagery and the feeling of what he's writing about. And I believed it. And the other soft tune was one called Mystery Man, which really kind of channels into the Allman Brothers and maybe a Sweet Melissa sounding song with some great slide work by Mike Campbell. The other three songs on this album kind of go sideways. It's totally different from the rest of the album, and really kind of haunting imagery and this dark driving sound in Stranger in the Night, and Petty just kind of painting the picture with his storytelling. And then as sweet and passionate as The Wild One Forever was, there's this other song called I've Been the Fool Again, and I Don't Like It. Just this just kind of angst, and Petty is pissed off, and it's this whole different sound. And the last song is called Luna, which is really just kind of hypnotic and mesmerizing, and it's really Petty and Stan Lynch coming together with vocal and drums and a synthesizer and organ, and it just creates this mood, and Lynch's backbeat that he builds up kind of strokes this intensity in the song, and it's kind of like, yeah, I can really get into this. This is cool stuff. This album on its own really kind of opened my eyes to the kind of depth and unique style and really the chops that this band had.
Well, that's certainly an enthusiastic review. I mean, now I'm going to go and listen to the record.
That's great.
John, you glom onto Petty's anti-corporate attitude in the making of one particular record. What record was that?
Well, it's interesting what Michael talking about the love he has for that first album that came out in 1976. And my Tom Petty love really crystallized over the album Damn the Torpedoes, which came out a few years later in 1979. People are probably familiar with Refugee and Don't Do Me Like That. What impressed me as I guess I was 14 at the time, I really glommed on to what Petty was doing and the singer-songwriter component there. But he was also a bit of a badass when it came to the way he wanted to get his records made and the way he wanted to do it. Once the Heartbreakers, as Michael described, had kind of, you know, come together and gelled, and you've got Ron Blair on the bass and the incomparable Mike Campbell, who I think is also a big reason why I loved Petty, because he had a great lead guitar player, unlike Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. Yeah, who's a lead guitar player for that band? I don't know. Do I care? Probably. Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band. Yes, you had Stevie Van Zandt and some, you know, Niles Lofgren. But Campbell really made that a rock band for me. And Petty, he had some balls. He decided to tell the record company, I think it was MCA. I'm kind of shooting from the hip here, but they were having some problems, and they had not given him enough money to record the record or whatever. And so he said, I'll just declare bankruptcy and take my own tapes away. And we'll see, you know, and I'll sort of bet on myself when it comes to whether the public will take this music and ultimately make me enough money to, you know, pay off my debts and pay off my studio time. And ultimately, he was right. Damn the Torpedoes, I think, became obviously the biggest selling album of his career at that point, skyrocketed him into another level. And he was able from that point on, I think, to kind of dictate how he would do his records, how he would do his tours, who he would hire. He wasn't struggling after Damn the Torpedoes because he essentially said, damn the torpedoes or damn the record company, I'm going to do it my way. That combined with that idea that he was not just another kind of a Dylan wannabe or Dire Straits, you had mentioned that kind of comparison, mm-hmm. Ted, I really glommed on him as a rock band. And give Petty credit, he came out in 79 with that record, Damn the Torpedoes, and somehow not only managed to be in a rock band, but got played in, lumped in with some of the new wave bands at the same time too. So you'd hear Tom Petty along with the Knack and the Plimsolls and these other bands, the Cars, yeah. Right? Yeah. He he's a Gainesville, Florida rocker with more in common with the Allman Brothers than with the Talking Heads, but he got lumped into that group too. So he had a lot of eyes and ears on Tom Petty, and I was one of them.
I remember that when I first saw pictures of them and even videos, they kind of dressed like a new wave band.
Right. And they were kind of built short, yeah, kind of goofy hairdos. But
The music was anything but. Now, I have a question for both of you, and I'll ask Michael the first one. Off that first record, just taking the hits out for a second and just put them in a little box, put them away. Name the one song that you think is one of the best deep cuts.
Oh, I would say there's a couple here. You know, it's the very first song on the album. It's called Rockin' Around With You. And it's kind of like if you shake up a soda bottle and then pop the cap. It's just kind of this release of energy and this drum beat, and it just brings you in right from the start. That's a deep cut that I really love. I would mention the other one too, would be Stranger in the Night, because it's so dark and different from really everything else on the album. And as the Heartbreakers sound developed over time, as you were talking about, you know, it moved more and more away from this kind of raw element as the band grew together.
Okay, let's play that first track just to get a flavor of it. John, off Damn the Torpedoes, what's your deep track?
My deep track off of Damn the Torpedoes is probably Louisiana Rain. Michael may be familiar with this tune. It's very different from a lot of the songs that you've heard played on the radio, and they were so good. That record is so full of good rock songs. Mm-hmm. But Louisiana Rain did what Michael described the Heartbreakers doing in their initial phases when they got together, is painting this picture. I mean, I am so sitting in the bayou enjoying jambalaya or doing whatever else I'd be doing when I hear Louisiana Rain. I believe there's some slide guitar work, which Mike Campbell, again, one of my favorite guitar players on the planet Earth, I think is doing. Ben Montench has some great keyboard work in that song.
Let's hear some of that. Why not?
Yeah.
The early albums, what about later Petty? What was it that you admired or just absolutely thought that this guy's still got it, a lot of integrity, and the songwriting is still really strong? What album would it be for you, Michael?
Wildflowers is by far my favorite album. I got to see Tom the first time at a Bridge School benefit, one of the first shows of the Bridge School tour, which went on for years. In Oakland, it was an acoustic set, and then I saw them on the Into the Great Wide Open tour, and that was just a great period for Petty, late 80s into the mid-90s with Full Moon Fever and Into the Great Wide Open, but Wildflowers has always been my favorite Tom Petty album, you know, almost 20 years after that debut, and just the depth of the songwriting and really how far along he had come as the crafter of song and the ability to tell that story.
I read an article, I think it was in Ultimate Classic Rock, that said that when he recorded the song, the title track, he just hit the recorder and the lyrics just sort of poured out of him. He didn't have anything written out.
Amazing.
He just sang it.
Yeah,
he just had to finish. And was it Jeff Lynne who helped him produce that record?
Jeff Lynne was definitely part of those first two I had mentioned, the Full Moon Fever and Into the Great Wide Open. I would have to double check on Wildflowers, but he was a huge influence there during that period. Yes.
But he may have been in the studio with him and just said, "But did you just make that up on the spot type thing?" He goes, "Yeah, man, it just kind of poured out of me." And he just played it back and it was like, "Can't believe it. A whole song just came out just by me starting."
Isn't that amazing? Just that talent and ability, which was always there. He just has always been able to find the right words.
What about you, John?
You know, he could not shake Jeff Lynne for about 10 years. Jeff Lynne was, come on, man, what are you doing? I'm still here, Tom. Let's record another tune. Come on, you can do it. I'm going to surprise you guys.
Are you a Wilbury?
Right, what are you, man?
What are you doing?
You've got Roy Orbison or whatever, you know, jangling on the big Gibson. What are you going to do, man?
But look, who's that knocking on the door? It's Dylan. Hey, right, man.
Come on, join. There's George Harrison. Let's have some fun then. I was a big Mary Jane's Last Dance fan, that 1993 addition to it, that greatest hits package that came out in 93. And I'll tell you why. Nostalgia is a little bit involved there because, as Michael knows, and maybe you do too, Ted, that Stan Lynch, who is also one of my favorite drummers, and I really felt like a real integral part of that Heartbreaker sound, was let go, fired, or however you want to describe, but, you know, depends on who you want to listen to, around the time that Wildflowers was getting recorded. I know he played on some cuts later on, but ultimately, Mary Jane's Last Dance is kind of the last stand for Stan Lynch on the drums. I think it's not only a great rock song, but it also shows Petty playing lead guitar. He plays some of the lead guitar breaks. It's one of those chances for Petty to show his guitar acumen, which he didn't do a lot of, although he was a fairly competent guitar player and, of course, wrote 99% of their songs on the guitar. The gritty part of that tune was Petty playing off of Mike Campbell, and that's why that's kind of my more modern Petty favorite.
I'm going to be the buzzkill in this love fest for a minute.
New words. And I've Southern accents. Here it comes.
I knew this was coming.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a fan of Petty's music. It kind of centers on both his music and Southern rock in general. And like I told you guys before we started recording this, this may rankle some fans, but here goes. It's after the record Southern Accents comes out, and this is like, what, 85 or so?
85.
By the way, you know, I bought it because I did see the video for Don't Come Around Here No More, and I loved it. I thought, wow, this doesn't even sound like Tom Petty. This is really kind of cool, thinking that there would be more of that on the record, and there really wasn't. But it's just like the anti-Petty sound, if you will. So I'm watching MTV, maybe, I don't know, about a year after that, and they played a concert from that tour. And at one point, Petty drapes himself in a Confederate battle flag and struts around the stage. And again, my issue with Southern rock in general is that, well, it has this kind of white racist contingent that sees, you know, that sees symbols like the Confederate battle flag as reflecting their own views. So in junior high and high school, and maybe people who listen to this podcast don't realize this, but I have brown skin tone and I have Asian Indian ethnic features. So there was always some redneck or some stoner asshole who loved Petty and his Confederate flags and decided that because I had brown skin tone and Asian Indian features that I was fair game for bullying, threats, or hurling unoriginal epithets at me. So because they were Petty fans and fans of Southern rock, it really turned me off Petty's music. I know a couple of years before his death, he told Rolling Stone magazine that he really disavowed the use of the Confederate flag on that tour and realized, even asking his fans not to display it anymore, that it just didn't go away. Now, here's another little piece of the puzzle that I didn't tell you. I had a girlfriend prior to dating my wife, Julie, who told me at one point, she said, you know, before dating you, my boyfriend gave me a Confederate flag to put on my bedroom wall. And I asked him why. And he says, because you're kind of a rebel. And this is sort of a rebel symbol. And she said, I didn't even think about all the other stuff that came with it. I was just thinking about it in terms of rebellion in general. And so when I read that Rolling Stone article about Tom Petty, he kind of came at it from the same point of view. He says, I just kind of grew up with this stuff around me. And we just always took it as a symbol of, you know, Southern heritage, Southern pride, and a sense of rebellion. But when I looked at that, and this is like 86, and I'm looking at that, and I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Howie Epstein is his bass player, and that guy's Jewish. Why would this guy be draping himself in the Confederate flag? It just kind of rankled me. Just like, it's like, God, I just couldn't shake that. And I brought this up to both of you prior to recording this, but that's my general issue with Petty and Southern rock in general, is that even though the artists themselves may not subscribe to what some of their fans read into symbols like the Confederate battle flag displayed on a tour or something, they themselves may not be racist. Their fans are. And then it just outwardly expresses to, like, me, that is what this music is about. And that's why I was like putting up these sort of, you know, roadblocks to it. I was just like, I can't really feel the love here, guys.
Makes sense to me.
Right. And I don't know how you feel about it, Michael. I'm a Caucasian from Southern Orange County where I grew up. I was never a real fan of Southern rock. And I think where I may have gotten turned sideways, Ted, is I never grew up assuming that Petty was Southern rock. I never put him in that category. I thought of him as having way more in common with, say, some of my new wave bands that I liked, or Bob Seger or Bruce Springsteen. I saw him as a band leader with a killer backup band and an amazing lead guitar player. I never thought of him in the same breath as Lynyrd Skynyrd or the Allman Brothers or
Molly Hatchet.
I just never lumped them together. Now that's my bad. I mean, because I didn't do the deep research when I was 14. I didn't realize Petty's from that area. He hung out with all those guys. That's his heritage. I always looked at him as a LA cool, long blonde hair, bunch of ragtag bandmates that were playing rock and roll that didn't have a Southern accent to it, in my opinion, at all, until ironically Southern accents came out.
What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I had some awareness of the background. I mean, Northern Florida, Gainesville is essentially Southern Georgia and Alabama, so and South Carolina. So it's the heart of the South. That is how they grew up. I have a lot of family from the South, actually, Tennessee, South Carolina. So a totally different point of view. And I see both sides. It didn't strike me the same at that age. And as I talked to you about it, Ted, before, at that time, mid-80s, early to mid-80s, I mean, the Dukes of Hazzard was still on mainstream network television with the General Lee car with the big right. Confederate flag on the roof. Yeah. So obviously times have changed, but I didn't see it that way. I mean, I thought it was something he was writing about from his own personal experiences growing up. If you listen to the live album from that tour, which is called Pack Up the Plantation, and you just listen to it on its own, you really get a feel for the entertainer, Tom Petty, the front man, the playfulness with the audience, and this band's incredible knack for cover songs.
Yes.
So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star leads off that concert. Shout is another one. Needles and Pins that he does with Stevie Nicks so beautifully. And the band just kicks ass live. You know, I was just listening to it and not taking in the visual, like you said, with right. the giant yeah. flag in the background.
You made me a CD after Petty died because we were talking about him. And I said, I'm not really a fan. You said, well, let me make you a CD. I think you might like some of these songs.
Nice.
And some of those live tracks are from Pack Up the Plantation, right?
They're actually from the Tom Petty Live Anthology.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, because I don't want it to be a total buzzkill, because I did have some favorite songs of covers that he and the band had done, like Mystic Eyes by Van Morrison,
so
License to Kill by Dylan, and Psychotic Reaction by the Count Five. I thought those were wonderful. I mean, I was just like, wow, this has totally changed my opinion of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. I'm listening to this, and I know these are covers.
Yeah.
But the way they covered them, I just thought, fantastic.
Yeah,
really,
the soul,
really well done.
The
yeah.
soul, the passion. By the way, the cover of Psychotic Reaction, that's Stan Lynch on the lead vocal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
God.
Yeah.
Awesome. I mean, so awesome. I miss Stan Lynch. I love
so
Steve
good.
Brown, but I miss Stan. Stan, we miss you.
John, you want to pick up on any of that thread?
I do. I just want to say, Ted, that what you brought to this discussion is not only important, but especially given where we're at now and how we've progressed, hopefully the direction that society, you know, in spite of what's gone on the last 4 years, where hopefully we're reheaded in that direction. And I think it's important to remember that ignorance isn't an excuse. And as much as I love Tom Petty and love the music, and especially the way Michael's describing how great the band is, I mean, even some of their more keyboard-esque type of stuff, like Love is a Long Road, I just think they're great musicians. They're a great, tight, rockin' band. I can't get over that. But it's not an excuse for ignoring some of those symbols of hatred, like the Confederate flag, like the whole scene. Pack Up the Plantation is also a video that I have. I actually have the video cassette of it. And there's a scene that I can never get over when he drapes himself around the flag after seeing it now. And his African-American backup singers are just smiling at him as he's kind of walking over to flirt with him a little bit while he's got this flag around him. And even as a 20-year-old, because I was 20 when that came out, that was still a disturbing image. I remember thinking, that's really weird, but it's Tom Petty. He's cool. He wouldn't be racist. He's got black backup singers. How can he be racist? I'm sure that was what was going through my mind, but it doesn't make it right. And I appreciate you bringing it up because I don't think we can bury what you described under, well, this guy's just an awesome musician, so he can get away with it.
I still think that, you know, 2 years before he died, he told Rolling Stone, they did like a whole article, very long piece too, about that specific tour. And he talked very much in depth about, you know, it was like one of his big regrets. He was like, yeah, that was a real mistake. I didn't realize what my fans were reading when I was, you know, draping myself in the flag. I didn't realize that this is kind of like putting a Nazi flag in front of a bunch of Jewish people or something. You know, it's just, he says, you have to understand where I came from in Gainesville and what it was like to grow up there and where the Confederate battle flag fit into that. And he says, and I just didn't think about it that way. Now I do. And I asked my fans not to bring those symbols into our shows because that's not who we are. We're not about that. That's not what our band is. That's not what our music is about. And we don't really want any part of that. So he totally disavowed it, which I totally thought it was great. You know, I was reading this thing. I thought, cool. But what I love about this conversation is that both of you guys have gotten me to reassess, reevaluate, and just listen with more open ears to this music from a rock perspective, you know, taking away some of the things that I initially back in, say, the mid 80s had put up as barriers are now just sort of, you know, dissolving. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I hear it. And especially that live stuff, man. Michael, that I just want to thank you for sharing that with me because that is some solid music.
Yeah.
They're solid players. I mean, they really are. John, you may have this record as well, but if you don't have it, man, that's one to add to your collection.
I tell you, I have Playback, which is that like 15 CD monster collection. Do people still have CDs? I do. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah.
I do.
Anyway, I've got, and I still find nuggets on that. I think it's a 6 CD thing of outtakes. And yeah, it's just, Michael, I'm sure you have it. It's that continues to be kind of a fun little treasure trove of nuggets that I'll rediscover just because it's fun to have that kind of collection around when you're a petty fan.
Out of these 6 CDs there, the other sides is the one that has all of the live cuts.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly when it is from, but to me, that's one of the best lineups of the Heartbreakers when you interchange Howie Epstein for Ron Blair. He just provides more strong, upper-level, high-range vocal. He's a multi-instrumentalist.
Yep.
And when he died, Petty replaced him with two guys. Blair came back and then Scott Thurston. But that other side CD, it's brilliant. Go back and just listen to the live cuts in there. They've never sounded better live.
That's a good place to end. Thank you, gents. That's a wrap for this segment. Michael Magali, thank you so much for joining in.
Awesome.
And as always, John, you rascal. Great chatting with you too.
I love you, buddy. Thanks again, Ted.
I'm becoming more of a fan and I appreciate both of your insights on Petty and his place in rock and roll. Music can often mirror the times we're going through. Think about any era of music, and you'll find example after example of some band or a singer who captures the zeitgeist of the moment. This moment of time, which is 2021 as I'm recording this, is certainly a unique experience. I don't think any of us expected a pandemic to upend our lives with economic conditions in turmoil or even a political culture that's marked by so much volatility. So there's a certain logic to seeing that a Scottish band, known mostly for their cinematic instrumentals for the past 25 years, had the most popular album in the UK. Well, as of the last week of February. That's right, Mogwai's 10th studio record, As the Love Continues, vaulted to the number one slot in record sales in the United Kingdom. And this isn't streams or MP3s we're talking about. This is about the sale of physical copies of vinyl and CDs. Okay, so I know that Mogwai is not a household name when it comes to music. And some folks may be wondering where their name comes from. It's certainly not Scottish, that's for sure. Well, if you're a fan of the movie Gremlins from 1984, you might remember the scene when the inventor Randall Peltzer comes home with a Christmas present for his son, Billy.
We're in Chinatown.
Can I pick him up, Dad?
Sure, go ahead. Just be careful. You gotta be gentle.
I will.
I hope he's housebroken.
Hmm. Oh, isn't he cute? Yeah. Has it got a name, Dad?
Yeah, Mogwai.
What?
Mogwai. I don't know, some Chinese word. I just call him Gizmo. He seems to like it.
So likely the band took the name from the film, and in a way, it's fitting that they did, since much of their music has been used in movies and even TV, like when the song Hungry Face served as the opening theme song for the 2012 French Supernatural series, which had the English translation of The Returned. That's a great series, by the way. Very haunting. And Mogwai's music really sets the tone in an effective way. But what of this new record? The one that was so popular right out of the gate in the UK. Well, the band continues with that cinematic sound they specialize in. But instead of a soundtrack for a movie, it's kind of the soundtrack for the pandemic we're living through. Not in a downbeat way, but the songs do express a kind of melancholy of the times. But it's also uplifting, too. There's a kind of hopefulness and even heroism that pervades the songs, almost all of which are instrumentals. For me, these songs were easy to get lost in. There's a kind of hypnotic quality to the experience of listening as the love continues. From the opening track, which is called "To the Bin, My Friend, Tonight We Vacate Earth," whose downbeat title doesn't reflect the vibe of the song, which really has a journey-like quality to it. The same goes for Here We Go Forever. Richie Sacramento sounds a bit like New Order in vocal delivery, and it's actually one of the only tracks on the album with a lead vocal. At first I didn't like it, but it stands out in a way that breaks up the album by adding more layers and variety to a sound that could have sunk the record by having too many sound-alikes. Not all the record works for me, however. Drive the Nail tries a little too hard to be aggressive for the sake of being aggressive. The song Fuck Off Money, yeah, that is the title of the song, sounds very much like Kraftwerk, which, all things told, is not a bad thing to draw upon. After that, Ceiling Granny, right on through the final track, which is called It's What I Want to Do, Mom, meld post-punk guitar work from New Order and The Cure era into more atmospheric and lush arrangements, using synthesizers and drums. Since music is so portable, we tend to listen to it while on the move, driving, walking, running, even biking. Well, with one earbud, and I did listen to this record while running, and there was something really hypnotic that allowed me to sort of surrender to the music and ignore any physical fatigue I was feeling early on the run, well, before the runner's high kicked in. So what's the takeaway from Mogwai's As the Love Continues? I really like the record for its ability to create a mood. Now, whether you're in the right headspace for their music to affect you is an open question. For those who have a streaming service like Apple, YouTube Music, Spotify, or Amazon, you already pay a flat rate for an all-you-can-eat listening experience, so there's not much out-of-pocket cost to giving this record a chance. Like anything, you have to live with it for a few days, if not a week. Once you do, it starts to work its magic on you. If you're sold on it after that, you'll probably do what I'm planning on doing, buying a physical copy at some point. I remember when I was a junior in college, I took a class from a professor who would later be a mentor of sorts to me. His name is Gene Weinstein, and he taught at San Francisco State University in the political science department. Now, the study of politics can be kind of dry and technical, but Gene had a way of using less than traditional methods to get his students interested in the topic. He'd use short stories, novels, reference films, and even read poetry to show how political ideas and themes often manifest themselves in art and literature. But truthfully, I think he found political science kind of boring, even though this is where he made his career. So why not liven up the discipline by bringing in readings that did just that? One day I remember him saying something along the lines of, well, as you spend the day struggling to understand Alexis de Tocqueville's observations of America, you might find yourself in the mood to read something light before dropping off to a night's slumber in a comfortable bed. So I'd like to suggest picking up a short story collection, which I happen to have a few right here. That's my best Gene Weinstein impersonation. And then he'd give us like a brief capsule summary of the collections. We all found his delivery super amusing. So much so, a group of us would often imitate him outside of class. But Gene was right. Sometimes a novel or even a lengthy nonfiction book on, say, the Dewey Decimal System is just a little too much. Something a little less daunting is needed. That's why I'm going to spotlight a previously unpublished story by Sylvia Plath. For those who don't know her, Plath was an accomplished poet and wrote a couple of novels, the most famous being The Bell Jar, but she's also known as a tragic artist who, after many failed suicide attempts, finally succeeded in February 1963. On the morning of the 11th, Plath sealed the windows and doors in her kitchen with towels and sheets, and then she turned on the gas in the oven, placed her head inside, and breathed in the fumes until she died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Pretty depressing stuff, huh? No doubt. But what's fascinating is a story she wrote when she was 20 years old at Smith College in Massachusetts. The story was rejected by Mademoiselle, even after she won a writing prize from the magazine. But 57 years later, it finally got published. The story is called Mary Ventura and the Ninth Kingdom, and it's a bit of a surreal tale in the mode of the Twilight Zone, but more like Twilight Zone light. The setup is fairly unremarkable. Mary Ventura, the title character, is leaving home and boarding a train. She's with her parents, who are seeing her off at the station, but Mary's kind of nervous and scared, not ready to leave yet. Her mother says, quote, "It will be an easy trip. Everyone has to leave home sometime. Everyone has to go away sooner or later." Well, she gets on the train and sits down, and as the train starts up, Plath introduces us to Mary's seatmate on the train, who plunks herself down and starts knitting a dress for a girl about the size of Mary. She's friendly and offers to buy Mary her something in the dining car. Mary gets a ginger ale and remarks how luxurious the train trip is. They eventually get back to their seats when the following exchange happens. A vendor opened the door at the front of the car and came swinging slowly along the aisle crying, "Candy, popcorn, cashew nuts. Get your candy, popcorn, cashew nuts." "Here," said the woman, opening her brown satchel and taking out a worn purse. "I'll get us both a chocolate bar." "Oh no," Mary protested. "Please, I'll pay for it." "Nonsense, dear," the woman said. "This is my treat. The chocolate will be good for your sweet tooth. Besides, you'll have enough to pay for by the end of the trip." The vendor stopped at their seat and pushed his red cap back on his forehead, sticking his thumbs in his red and white striped silk vest. "What'll it be?" he began in a routine, bored voice. "We have..." He paused, looked closely at the woman, then, and burst out into a raucous laughter. "You're making this trip again?" His voice dropped to a low, confidential tone. "There's nothing for you in this load, you know. The whole deal is signed, sealed, and delivered. Signed, sealed, and delivered." "Don't be so sure, Bert," the woman smiled amiably. "Even bookkeepers can go wrong now and then." "Bookkeepers, maybe, but not the boss." Bert jingled his black change purse with a sly grin. "The boss has got this all sewed up. Personally. This time. Personally." The woman broke into a rich laughter. "Yes, I should think so. After the mistake he made on the last trip, getting trains crossed on the higher level, why, he couldn't get those people out of the lower gardens now if he tried. They took to the gardens like children, happy as larks. You think they'd obeyed him and go back to the lower subway where they belong? Not on your life." Bert screwed up his face like a monkey. "Yeah," he said, subdued. Yeah, I suppose you got to get some percentage some of the time. That's why I'm here, the woman said. I'll take a chocolate bar. Large or small? Large, the woman replied and handed him a quarter. Well, bye now, Bert said, touching his cap. Happy hunting. And he swung off down the aisle, calling in a bored sing-song. Candy, popcorn, cashew nuts. Clearly, this is no ordinary train ride, and Mary's journey is one that becomes more surreal as it's clear her destination to the Ninth Kingdom isn't what she was expecting. Mary Ventura and the Ninth Kingdom reflects Plath's state of mind during that time, and it wasn't good. She was struggling with depression. Her science classes in college were giving her a lot of grief, and a sense of impending doom sort of surrounded her. So it's somewhat heartening to read that the story doesn't have a tragic end, unlike its author. The story is worth reading as it gives one a look into the mind of a young writer whose control over a number of elements in a short story is really impressive, especially at the young age of 20. Hey, and thanks so much for listening to the Rooks and Beckards podcast. As always, I hope you really enjoyed it. I want to thank John Young,
as always,
and Michael McGauley for talking about Tom Petty. A lively discussion it was. I try to post new podcasts each week, and the best way to know when a new episode is available is simply by subscribing. You can do so on Apple Podcasts. We're also on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon, which is also Audible. They've posted it on both Amazon Music and Audible. Hey, how about that? So basically, wherever you get your podcasts, Rooks and Beckards is probably listed there. My name is Ted, and I'll be back next time to talk more about books and records.